I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I want you to ask me anything. I'm doing a solo stream. This is a fundraising live stream. We are doing our annual fundraiser. It has started back on the 10th of March, which is our anniversary of when we were deplatformed from our last credit card processor. That's been quite a while now, and we have been doing just fine without regular credit card processors. However, we do have a couple of sites that will take your credit card if you would like to donate to us. One of them is Entropy. You can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. It's across the bottom of your screen. Or you can use Cash App. And again, you can use the address, the $ plus countercurrents without the hyphen, if you would like to send a donation along with a question or a comment. I will get to them in the course of today's stream. I have a whole bunch of questions that have been sent in over the last week and a half or so, and I promise I will get to them all in the course of this. So I would like to first thank a few people, though, who have sent in some money without any questions. But anyway, I just want to thank Penseroso. We received your $6. Richard, thank you for 100 euros. Most generous. Anglian. This was earlier this week for the Bowden live stream, sent $3 and asked, can I suggest a future guest, Steve Brady? Andrian and Eddie both know him. Okay, I will ask them about him. Seburez sent $6, thank you. And Ty has sent $120, which is that's a renewal for your paywall. We will get on that, I promise you, and keep you behind the paywall. We started a paywall 4 years ago. 4 years ago, 1 year ago. And the paywall is now coming up for renewal. And I think the paywall community has grown very nicely. It's worked out quite well. We have hundreds of people who are behind the paywall. Not all of them comment. The two privileges of being behind the paywall at Countercurrents, besides just feeling virtuous for helping us out, which is its own reward, right? We have two additional rewards. One is that your comments don't have to wait in a moderation queue, so you can start having real time back and forth with other paywall people on the platform. That's developing, that's worked out, and people are happy with that. I'm really happy with the comment community. And the other perk is that you get immediate access to everything, whereas about five things a week generally are put behind the paywall, and they are available to the public a month after that. So there's a 30-day delay for about 25% of the material we publish is delayed 30 days, but paywall people get it immediately. So it's a good deal. So I want to go to, I got a question here from Fritz Chrysler. $10 Canadian, thank you very much. People who are very sympathetic to white nationalism live among whites and assimilated into white society, but themselves are not white. Such a person who appreciates European history and tradition and has always been pro-white in their activity, what should happen to such a person in the movement? Well, here's the thing. There are people like this. A few years ago at American Renaissance, Jared Taylor did a reading of letters he'd received over the years from non-white appreciators of American Renaissance, non-white appreciators of white people, wondering why white people are behaving so crazily and why won't they stand up for themselves and things like that. It's completely possible for there to be non-whites who look upon what's happening to white people as the greatest crime in human history, the greatest tragedy in human history, something that is going to destroy not just the white world, but the rest of the world eventually if we finally go down as a race and as a civilization. They see that. They're intelligent. They're broad-minded. They see that. And we can't dismiss that. We can't say, well, they're fake or who cares or they're inferior or stuff like that. There are a lot of people in our broader movement who would be just dismissive of that. There are also people who want to help. They're allies. And I think that we should be open to having allies. We win by having fewer people fighting against us and more people fighting with us on our side. And that can include non-white allies who sympathize with our cause. So there are people like that. They are not trusted in the movement. And there are always people who are going to do cheap shots with such people. Hardy har har, how can anybody like white people if they're half black or something like that? And it's just a dumb, easy take, right? They'll put it out like it's the most novel thought on the planet, but it's a really old take, and it's not particularly profound. There are people who are not white who can sympathize with our cause, even help our cause. And my attitude towards them is, let's help them. Now, if they come in and they start saying, you really need to clean up this movement here. You need to make this more accessible to non-whites. At a certain point, you've got to say, okay, this is an operation of some sort. This person is acting in bad faith. This person is ankle biting us and driving us around. This person should be more concerned with policing their own co-racialists and getting them to scale back on the anti-white hate than they should be policing our own ranks. And generally, if somebody is a sincere outsider and a genuine ally, that's what they do. They're out there saying to their fellow Jews or their fellow blacks or their fellow Asians, cool it with the anti-white hate. They're not in our ranks saying, you need to make this movement more comfortable for non-whites. No, it's kind of our club in the primary sense. And we're going to save ourselves. We're going to have to save ourselves. And if we're going to be saved at all, it's going to be primarily us that does it. Now, we can have some helpers, but they have to do that on our terms, and they don't set the terms. And if they start trying to set the terms, we're going to wonder, what's the end of this road, and is it going to look fundamentally different from the cowed and cucked white race that we're starting out with today? So those are my basic thoughts on this. Scott writes in with $10. Thank you very much. Greg, you said you're a naturalist, but doesn't our moral experience of events like Waukesha betray naturalism? When events like that occur, most people don't think, oh no, now their genes won't be propagated. Rather, they think the loss of human life itself is tragic. Well, I don't know if your argument really works. I am a naturalist, but what does that mean? Well, I think that values come from nature, but when we see old people die, like those old people in Waukesha who were run down by this idiot, we don't think, oh, well, they had their chance. They had their kids. Their genes have been propagated. Why don't we do that? Well, actually, in a way we do. In a way we do, because generally what people will do after an old person dies is they'll say, well, she had a full life, right? And what does that mean? It means that this person has had the full range of human experience. And one of the things that's very important in that is passing on their genes to the next generation, making sure there is going to be a next generation. That's an important thing to do. And if a person who's old and who has reproduced and maybe seen a few grandchildren dies, it's far less tragic in our eyes than when a child dies. Why? Well, because children have more future ahead of them than old people. And so they've lost more. But the reason why, when you see a tragic event, a horrific event like that massacre of old white people and children by this crazed, hateful Negro who should not have been out on bail, well, frankly, he shouldn't have been in a white country to begin with. If white people had a country of our own, the Waukesha massacre would never have happened. Remember that, people. But the reason why we react with horror to that is because we feel sympathy to the victims. We feel compassion. Now, I think compassion is a biologically mandated kind of feeling, and it's what you feel immediately when you see somebody suffering. And the more genetically similar that person is to you, the more you feel it. There's no question about that. That's established fact. But I even feel for animals, especially cute animals that, Don't threaten me, right? I even feel for dogs with big brown eyes when they suffer, right? That's natural. That's based in nature. It can be understood in terms of genetic similarity theory. And when people react in horror at death and suffering, they're reacting based on empathy. And empathy is a pro-social, pro-biological reaction that we feel to the suffering of others, and especially others who share more of our genes. So there's very much a selfish gene thing at work here. If our genes are selfish, why can we be altruistic? Well, because our genes are also present in other people. And sometimes, in fact, inevitably, our genes are going to be better off and live on in other people after we die. And sometimes we can ensure that by giving our lives up. And we can ensure that, help that by doing lots of things short of giving our lives up, like helping, like being kind. And so I think the sympathetic reaction that people have to terrible events like that is perfectly explicable in terms of naturalistic causes. I think that that's a pretty adequate account, actually. So I want to thank you for that, Scott. Sutton wrote in and asked me, will you be debating E. Michael Jones again? Now, if you didn't tune in last week, over on Telegram at the Guide to Culture channel, if you weren't there, you might not know that exactly a week ago, I was debating E. Michael Jones on the question of whether nationalists should be sympathetic to Ukraine or Russia in the current war. And I don't know what all of you thought. I know what some of you thought. You've been very kind in your comments for the most part. But I wasn't super happy with my performance. The main reason I wasn't happy with it is that I was under the impression that I could read about a 2,000-word statement at the beginning, and then Jones would read about 2,000 words at the beginning. And then we would have rebuttals and stuff like that. And then when we were in the meeting just beforehand, I was said that, no, that we had only 10 minutes for each of our opening statements. So I was thinking 20 minutes. And so I had to start abridging things as I was going along. And I managed to get my opening statement, which I had written for 20 minutes, down to 13 minutes or so. And then Jones proceeded to give a 4,000-word 20-plus minute statement of his own. So that sort of set things off on the wrong course because I had to edit on the fly and I didn't think it was a very smooth production. However, I think that my argument is very good and sound, and Jones offered nothing to overturn my argument. And in fact, I didn't so much beat him as he defeated himself because he just went off on some huge tangents. Basically, he started out with the history of Jews in that part of the world. And then he, because if you drop the word Jew to certain people, they start frothing, right? It's a trigger word. And then he started dropping the gay disco meme, which is another trigger word to get these people frothing. But he didn't really present much of an argument for why we should prefer Russia to Ukraine as nationalists. And that's the perspective that we were supposed to take as nationalists. I didn't think it was very edifying, frankly, the debate, but I would debate him again if it's for a good cause. That's basically it. I would debate him again if it's for a good cause. I don't think it would be a particularly edifying debate because I don't think the last one was particularly edifying. But if it was for a good cause, I would do it again because it's bound to be entertaining. I do think the debate had some entertainment value to it. So anyway, those are my thoughts. I would debate him again, but only for entertainment value, for a good cause, if it's a way of raising funds for something. I would debate him again if it was a way of raising funds to send rockets to the Azov division, for instance. I'd be happy to do that. Anyway, that's that. Matty has written in, and he sent $3, and he wants to know my thoughts on the Will Smith slap. Okay, that's great. And also, we have a donation here from Gaddius Maximus, who sends $25. That's very generous. What are your thoughts on honor culture? You said earlier this week there was good reason why countries outlawed dueling. It seems that there is a strong relation between declining honor culture and public virtue. Isn't slapping someone for insulting your loved ones in public a good thing? So I want to talk about the Will Smith slap. Before I say anything more, though, I would like to point out that we have two really quite excellent pieces on this up at Countercurrents. One by Jim Goad and the other by Nicholas Gilvey. And if somebody can link these in the various chats, that would be great. I would appreciate that a lot. Those are both very well written, very entertaining, and make good points. So take a look at those. My thoughts on it are somewhat similar to both, but let me just sort of lay my take out because I don't have time to write it out. So this is these are my thoughts on the Will Smith thing. This is where you're going to find them, verbally, not written out. Now, first of all, let's look at the actual Will Smith thing. I thought that Jim Goad's discussion of it was quite good. Chris Rock got up there and was joking around, and he's had some pretty barbed jokes directed at Jada Pinkett Smith in the past, apparently. When she boycotted the Oscars, he pointed out that she wasn't invited. So what good is a boycott? You know, it's just an empty gesture. I thought that was good. And he said, "Jada, I love you. G.I. Joe 2 or G.I. Jane 2, looking forward to it." And he was referring to the fact that her head was shaved. Now, I don't follow Negro Hollywood figures. So I wouldn't know anything about Jada Pinkett Smith's hair or something. Apparently she's got alopecia, her hair's falling out, she's got to shave her head, whatever. Anyway, it was funny. It was genuinely funny. I think that in that community, you expect a little bit of good-natured roasting and ribbing when you put one of these comedians on the stage. So I sort of thought it should be all well and good and all within the rules of the game that these people play. And Will Smith laughed at it. It was genuinely funny. I was amused by it when I saw it. Will Smith laughed, and then he looked over and saw his serpent-faced, bald-headed wife staring daggers at him. And wimp cuck that he is, he went up there and smacked Chris Rock and went through this charade of being an outraged gentleman, that this man had insulted his wife's honor, etc. I don't think it was scripted. The whole thing wasn't scripted. I think that's dumb. But it was clearly contrived. His initial reaction was to laugh along with it. But then, because he apparently has a real handful with his wife, she's a real bitch by all appearances. She's unfaithful to him. Apparently they have an open marriage. So she's unfaithful to him. She's probably very difficult to live with. He saw those eyes and that face and knew he had to do something, or he was going to just never hear the end of this. And so he went up there and performed the role of a dishonored, aggrieved husband defending his wife's honor. And I thought it seemed rather fake to me. I mean, I think Jim's account of the narrative is clearly correct. So the big question is, what do we take away from this? And really, two camps have formed within our movement. One camp is to say, this is honor culture behavior. We should applaud this. And the other is to say, this is Negroes being Negroes. And this is shocking behavior. And this is a sign of public standards declining ever further because we have now made Black people into quasi-divine figures, saintly figures, sacred cows that get to wander around, clogging up traffic, bringing our society to a halt. And we can't touch a hair on their head because they're sacred. We would be in danger of committing the sin of racism and having our entire lives destroyed. So we just have to let them behave this way until somebody finally stops it. Or, well, they're not even thinking that far. They're just hoping that it'll all go away, that they'll finally get over it, and that they'll finally stop. Of course, they're never going to get over it because they're being rewarded for this constant charade of aggrievement and victimhood. Will Smith lives in a house that's worth $20 million or more, you know, in a gated community near Los Angeles. I'm sure he has other houses that are quite valuable. He's extremely rich and privileged. And still, apologists for his behavior are treating him as a victim of white supremacism. It is to laugh. These are Blacks in general, and especially Hollywood Blacks like Will Smith, are an objectively privileged and pampered cast. And unfortunately, they're not the noblest people in the world. They're not the smartest people in the world. A lot of them are just vicious children who are taking advantage of the license they have because they live in this bubble of untouchability, this bubble of You can't criticize them. They're sacred. There are sacred cows. Vicious children and black people take advantage of that. You'd have to be a saint not to take advantage of the kind of latitude and privilege that blacks have in our society. And because of this, we have seen cities burn. We have seen crime run amok. We have seen all of our standards, our statues toppled, our standards toppled, our culture defaced and defamed and defiled. You know, utter filth and degeneracy are celebrated. Very questionable black contributions to culture are being lionized. The whole Oscars ceremony was disproportionately about movies about the dignity of black people and their suffering in America, right? It's just a giant con job, and it will never end. It will never end until white people bring a halt to it, because they're not going to stop, because they're highly incentivized to do this, and because they're impulsive and they're greedy and they're dumb and they don't have any breaks. They're not going to stop. We're going to have to stop. We have to be the adults here. I see no sign of that happening with the current establishment. So I'm just sick of privileged blacks behaving badly in public and blaming it all on whitey, blaming it on me, blaming it on you, blaming it on white people who don't have the same privilege and certainly don't have an ounce of the wealth and prestige and social connections of somebody like Will Smith. I'm sick of that. And so my inclination is to go strongly on the side of the message that we should go heavy on. This is what you get by making blacks sacred. He was one of the good ones, right? As Jim said, he was one of the ones who wouldn't microwave your puppy or rape your daughter or play knockout games with your arthritic grandfather to impress his homies, right? He was one of the good ones, and he still behaves this way. Well, anybody will behave badly if you can't criticize them and if there are no consequences for their bad behavior. And that's what we're doing with blacks who are, let's just put it this way, crime and accident prone as it is. So we've created this terrible moral hazard by turning blacks into sacred cows and perpetual victims and people we have to genuflect before, people we have to make excuses for, people that we have to roll our eyes and bite our tongues and hope that they'll get over this bad attitude that they've got. It's never going to happen. We've created this vast moral hazard, and from top to bottom, our society is rotting. And now something that used to be, and I know this is kind of fake, but it used to be considered classy. The Oscars used to be considered classy. And I know it's not very classy. The Hollywood movie industry is incredibly corrupt and horrible, but it used to be sort of classy entertainment that even I watched in the past, right? I felt invested in it in some way. I used to be a big movie buff. I've written 5 books on film. You know, I've seen more films than I've read books probably, and that's a shameful thing to admit. But I used to be invested in this, and I'm very skeptical of it. Now I wouldn't watch the Oscars for anything. I haven't watched them in years. And hearing about this just made me think, yeah, this is another big step down in our cultural decline. And for a lot of people who are less red-pilled than you and me, this was a very revealing moment. We all know what's going on, but a lot of normies don't. There weren't that many normies watching this. In the past, there would have been a lot more. Those normies have tuned out, but it's being discussed everywhere. It's being discussed in beauty salons and around water coolers and in barbershops, on trains and things like that. And white people are not comfortable with this. And this is a good way of red-pilling them. It's a good way of raising these uncomfortable questions about why we have to patronize these people who are destroying our civilization. And so I think that's a good route to take. I think that's the route that we should invest the most in. Now, some people in our movement think, well, you know, if somebody insulted my wife, I'd slap them across the face too. And you might not do it only after your wife stares daggers at you and shames you into doing it. You might actually be a genuine upstanding guy who's going to defend his wife's honor. What's wrong with that? Well, Nick Gilvey made a good point we tend to misunderstand Black behavior when we project white behavior on it. Blacks are a matriarchal society, a matrifocal society. Black men are tyrannized over by Black women for the most part. What we're seeing here is not chivalry. We're not seeing the strong guy protecting the weak. We're seeing a weak guy being manipulated into let's him and you fight kind of behavior by his evil wife. That's what we're seeing. We're not seeing, a 19th century gentleman smacking a guy with his glove and challenging him to a duel because he's said something mean about his wife. That's a white thing. And it's superficially similar to what we saw, but it's not the same thing. But that still leaves open the question, shouldn't we want to have more of an honor culture? Shouldn't we bristle when people dishonor us? Shouldn't we even be willing to do things that are violent? Okay, the answer is yes and no. Okay, and I'm going to give the yes argument before I give the no argument. And the yes argument, I think, is actually a very strong argument. So bear with me. If you are known as the kind of person who will reach for his sword when he is insulted, people will be less likely to insult you. They will be less likely to trifle with you. They'll be less likely to mess with you. If white people were a little more waspish about our honor, we would be less trifled with. We would be given greater respect. We wouldn't be treated badly. The knockout game would not happen. People would be afraid to do that. They would be genuinely afraid of that. And that's a good thing. It would be good for white people, especially white men, to be feared more by people who would abuse us, by people who would victimize us. And that's why I think that we should have a somewhat, tolerant attitude, a tolerant attitude towards people who would, you know, smack Chris Rock across the face for insulting his wife. I would say that we should not necessarily make it legal to do that. I still think it should be considered simple assault to do things like that. It should still be something that could be adjudicated in a court or at least looked at by a prosecutor, but there should be a great deal of lenience for people who do this, and most of these things should never go to court. And the only circumstances under which they should go to court is if the person behaved in a completely insane and excessive way. Yeah, you know, there's one thing, you know, to slap a guy across the face for insulting your wife. It's another thing to drag him behind your car, right? That kind of stuff. So we would have to have some standards here, and there should be, I think, an acceptance of police and judicial review. But there should be a lot of leniency at the same time. Why? Because it will create a culture where people are less likely to hurt one another and mistreat one another. If people can take offense and go violent over it, fisticuffs, not guns and swords, right? That will create a culture that's more peaceable and more polite. Jim Goh talked about when he was locked up in jail. And the surprising thing about his experience in prison was that people were extremely polite. Why? Because they knew that if they weren't polite, things could escalate very rapidly into levels of violence that they were not comfortable with. These people were not to be trifled with. And so it was a fairly polite environment. And I think that's very interesting. Maybe we should emulate the people in that jail a little bit, in the sense that we should be a little more hair-triggered. We should find ways of signaling that we're those sort of hair-triggered types of people, so that we're given a wide berth and aren't tested. But there's some value to that, no question about it. Why is dueling illegal? Well, dueling, you know, is you take an insult and you turn it into a murder. Also, there's a rude assumption of dueling. If you look at the ancient past, you know, the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages, that it's a way of determining who's right. They actually had trial by combat to determine who was innocent or guilty on the assumption that the stronger party would be the one that God has on his side and therefore is the party in the right. I mean, that's completely absurd. But dueling, in a sense, has residues of that kind of idea in it. If you're wronged, might doesn't make right. And it's not a way of determining who's in the right at all. So you'd simply have to put that aside, questions like that aside. Another reason to get rid of dueling and why it's become illegal is that it's connected with primitive societies that are clannish and have endless cycles of tit-for-tat violence. You insult somebody, somebody's sister, well, they're going to come after you, and their children are going to come after your children, and their grandchildren are going to come after your grandchildren. There are societies that still exist that way. I met this guy from Albania, very nice guy, young guy, very, very bright. And he said, yeah, Albania is a very homogeneous society. It's very traditional. You have a strong sense of identity. And then he got a little thoughtful and he said, of course, part of the identity is wanting to murder other people because they belong to different clans and you have ancient grudges against them. And so there's some downsides to Albania too. One of which is that it's one of these very clannish societies where you have ancient blood feuds. Those are very bad. And you can't really have a high trust, large scale civilization, right? If when you're hiring people to work at the local ice cream parlor, you have to look at their family histories to make sure that the new employees don't have blood feuds against the existing ones. Now, if you were opening an ice cream parlor in Albania or Somalia, you'd literally have to do that kind of stuff. I'm sure in certain parts of Appalachia, you know, and until recently, maybe even now, there would be people that still have these sorts of blood feuds. And it just impedes the smooth functioning of a large scale, highly scalable, high trust Western type society to have that kind of attitude. Generally, the best forms of society allow the law to adjudicate matters of justice. You don't just take it into your own hands. However, there's a strong argument to be made that people would be a lot more polite if we were lenient when people insult you and you act the part. You are the dishonored party. You're not just pretending. You sincerely feel righteous indignation, and yeah, you lash out. If you don't go overboard, right, there should be a great deal of leniency for that, and we would have a much politer society. We can't really do that if we've got blacks around either, right? Because blacks are the kind of people, you insult somebody and they come back with their MAC-10 and spray bullets around your funeral, your family funeral, or your garden party. Your garden party, what am I saying? Your block party or something like that, right? You just can't have that kind of culture with people like that around. So those are my thoughts on the matter. I think the Smith thing, yeah, I rolled my eyes at this because, well, first of all, I was shocked at how much people I knew in our movement knew about Will Smith. I knew almost nothing about him. He was just somebody who would pop up occasionally in trailers for movies that I always gave a pass to. So I don't know that much about him. But a lot of people seem to know a whole lot about him. And I got rapidly schooled about Will Smith in the course of this controversy from people that hadn't ought to know that much about Negro celebrities. I'm kind of proud at how ignorant I was of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith and all this stuff before this happened. But anyway, I do think that the best take that our movement can make on this is to really stress that this is the inevitable decline of turning Black people with low IQs and low empathy and extremely impulsive, violent behavior into sacred cows that we can't criticize. I think that's the best take. I do think it is reasonable to talk within our ranks about honor society and things like that, which we're doing right now. But the last thing I want to do is defend Will Smith, because if Will Smith had a Mac-10 with him, he would have sprayed that stage with bullets. And we shouldn't project our kind of honor culture behavior onto their kind of quote unquote honor culture behavior. Their "you disrespected me" type behavior, because I think there are very different dynamics there. And their behavior, in addition to a lot of other other limitations, makes it impossible for them to have large-scale, high-trust civilizations. We can do that, but we have to find a way of getting our honor culture and our waspishness and our thumos in check. Not squash it out entirely. We can't do that, and it's not desirable. And I honestly think that the great problem of bourgeois civilization is that we become too reasonable, too ruled by our desires, too conflict averse, and not honorable enough, not willing to fight enough, not thumotic enough. So there's truth to that, definitely. But I still think that there are good reasons why we got away from things like duels and clan blood feuds and things like that. Anyway, that's a lot on a good question. So thanks, Gadius, and thanks, Maddie. Sergey has written in, "Have you read Scott Ritter's Russia Cope?" Okay, Scott Ritter, I forget his origins. I remember him in connection with like the Iraq War. He's made his rounds in like alternative media and things like that. Scott Ritter seems to be suckling from the Kremlin's teat on the Ukraine war. And he published this tweet thread, which has been widely circulated in our circles, talking about how Russia has been engaged in a masterful feint. They sent half their army at Kiev just to tie down the Ukrainian forces so that they could do what they really wanted to do, which was concentrate on taking over the Donbass region. Now, I read this and rolled my eyes because there's a lot of people going along with, basically there are a lot of people out there fluffing Putin and shilling for Putin, talking about how Putin is this saintly figure. He's doing a kind and gentle invasion. You know, his real armies haven't even left Russia yet. They're trying to save civilian lives. The reason why they haven't advanced and now have been rolling back from where they were a week into the war is because of their great forbearance, his saintliness, Putin's saintly forbearance. It's all a bunch of rubbish. What happened is that the Russians sent half their army at least towards Kiev, hoping that they could do a quick regime change, knock it over in a few days, take over the country, dictate the terms. I think that's obviously the strategy. You don't send half your army on a strategic feint. So he sent half his army there, Putin did, to try and knock over the government in Kiev and failed miserably. And then we started hearing about 3 weeks later, coming out of the Kremlin and Kremlin sources, that Russia has actually achieved its strategic goals. They didn't really want to take Kiev anyway. Now they're going to focus on Donbass. Well, I don't believe that for a minute. I just think that's coping. And I think that what Ritter is trying to do is he's trying to turn a failure into a brilliant strategic success. And I just wonder what his motives are. And think it's goofy. It's very, very interesting that there's so many people who are willing to wager their credibility on being reply guys and basically press shills for Putin, coming up with the excuses and basically whitewashes for this war, which never should have been launched. And is frankly not going very well for the Russians. I'm sorry, but it's been, 5 weeks now? Russia got bogged down a week in because there was a lot more Ukrainian resistance than they had banked on. And now they're retreating. Now they've been forced back in many places, and now they're just pulling out of the Kiev area. Now, of course, it's very likely that they might try and redeploy these troops in the east. That's probably what's going to happen. But let's not pretend that that was plan A all along. I think that they're falling back to plan B. They're scaling back enormously their ambitions. And at the end of this war, they might lose a lot of men, a lot of equipment, a lot of prestige, a lot of money, and basically stay in control of what they already basically had, which was Crimea and these fake breakaway republics in the east, Donetsk and Luhansk, maybe a little territory around them. But I think this is looking like a debacle. And so, yeah, I thought Ritter, I just don't get it. I don't get the Putin fanboys. I don't get their little games that they play. Is this a game for these people? It sure seems like it's just a game for these people, like it's a spectator sport. It's a known fact that men, especially, find it very, very easy to identify with sports teams. And when their sports team wins, they feel like they've won. Their testosterone even goes up. And you see this funny behavior, on game day. They're pretending to spike the ball in the end zone. They're miming. They're pantomiming the activities of the stuff on the field, and they feel like winners or losers. They are imaginatively identified with this figure, and they've invested a lot of themselves in it, and their emotions are connected with this. So if the team wins, they feel like winners. If the team loses, they feel like losers. I think a lot of the Putin cheering is just fanboy behavior. It's basically sports behavior. It's cheering team Putin. And it's especially appealing to people who in their lives are impotent, right? Highly alienated people whose values are basically despised in the public realm, who were treated as the number one threat to national security, who are basically treated as less desirable neighbors and child molesters, right? People in our movement, people like that, people who feel disempowered and alienated, love to feel like Putin is fighting their battle for them. Because they can just stay at home and look in the internet and watch and kibitz and chat rooms and on social media and feel like they're winning for a change. And so a lot of people are very, very invested in Putin winning and pushing the narrative that Putin's winning because they think, it makes them feel like they're winning if they can just believe it. And if they can make other people believe it, that makes them feel like they're winning. And also, on some level, they think that if enough people believe that he's winning, he really will win. That's why propaganda is put out. Projecting victory, right, is a way of achieving victory. I remember the very first day of this war looking on uns.com and seeing people saying Mariupol has fallen. The leaders of Azov have fled to Poland. Well, you know, 5 weeks or 5 weeks later, Mariupol hasn't fallen. Azov is still fighting. I don't know what new lies they're coming up with because I just basically stopped looking at those sorts of websites. It's just disgusting to me. But anyway, I think a lot of it is fanboyism and sports ball type enthusiasm, living vicariously, feeling, pretending based on an active imaginative identification that they have a champion out there in the world. It's not unlike Cutardism, because what is Cutardism based on? It's based on the idea that there are people in power in America. There's a deep state type apparatus that's really our friend. It's really on our side. And we have to trust their plan. And they're going to carry the ball for us. And they're going to make the things that we want happen, right? It's a very appealing fantasy. People who are given to that kind of fantasizing and sports ball type behavior, air guitar players, right? They're playing air guitar, pantomiming, and think that they're the guy on stage. They're the star. It's a kind of childish, cute thing, but it's not the basis of political analysis. And I think that's basically all I've got to say about that. So anyway, let's go on because I've got a bunch of other questions here. So thank you, folks, for sending your questions and comments. Helen has written in with $3, and she asks, Greg, do you think Viktor Orban will win re-election? Viktor Orban, Hungary's prime minister, is going up for re-election tomorrow. Sunday, the 3rd of April. He has served 4 terms as prime minister. This will be his 5th. And I think he's going to win. I haven't been following it extremely closely. Somebody who's been following it much more closely is John Morgan, who just published today a piece on countercurrents. I urge you to look at that. I think that Orban's going to win because really his opposition is this weird coalition consisting of ex-socialists and communists and people from the right, further to the right of Orban. These people don't get along all that well, but they have come together because they want to get rid of Orban. They have the kind of incoherent platform that you would expect from this kind of alliance. The shadow figure behind it is a former prime minister who was basically overthrown after a secret meeting where he was talking about how basically Hungary is a whorehouse country and Hungarians are a bunch of fools. And he's just lied about how badly he's fucked up the Hungarian economy. When this got out, there were literally riots in Hungary over this. This guy is trying to claw his way back into power. And the idea that this guy could ever get power again, that he couldn't be just disqualified for life from politics, is shocking to me. But I guess they just don't do things like that in Hungary. He's picked this sort of bland guy with a large family as his puppet, his front man who's running against Orban. For the life of me, I don't know what this guy stands for. At the end, they hardly did any advertising for a long time, I was told. Then at the end, they started coming out with wild claims that Orban is helping Russia spy on NATO, that in the last election, it was stolen because of votes from foreign Hungarians. Ethnic Hungarians who live outside of Hungary, there are about 3 million of them, can vote in Hungarian elections. And they like Orban a lot, because he gave them that right and because he represents Hungarian nationalism in an appealing way to Hungarians who live outside of Hungary, because in 1919, Hungary was partitioned up and large amounts of its territory, and large numbers of ethnic Hungarians found themselves in other countries. So anyway, I think he's very likely to win. He might not win as big a parliamentary majority as he has won in the past, but I don't even think that's really going to stop him or slow him down. He did a couple of, I think, brilliant things in recent years. He came out against, how to put it, too much sex education too early, especially with the LGBT stuff. Frankly, I thought what he proposed was weak tea. I don't think that there should be sex education in public schools at all until people are in, you know, health class in high school and they get a little bit of basic information about like reproductive health and, you know, just to know what's going on in case their parents aren't informing them. But all this gender identity stuff, this should not be in the schools. This should not be part of education. You should not be confusing kids with this sort of stuff. They just don't need to know it. And they should be protected from that. What Orban proposed was pretty weak tea, but of course the left predictably went nuts. The trouble was is that his opposition consists of lefty leftists, including ex-communists and people like that, who are all for they're all for the worst kind of stuff in the United States. And it consists of people from the Jobbik party who are really opposed to all of that kind of stuff. And so it was a masterful way of getting his enemy coalition fighting with one another, to put this out there. The recent Russia-Ukraine war has helped him too. Orban was sort of weak on this because he's been very pro-Russia. He's been very diplomatic towards Russia. He wants to be friends with Putin. His attitude about Russia and China, for that matter, is that Hungary cannot depend entirely on the good graces of the West, because that is the source of the pause. That's the source of the State Department and NGO funding that's trying to overthrow him and open his country up to the third world tide. He cannot depend entirely on the West, and so he's sought good relations with people outside the Western bloc. I think it's very sound. It's very out of tune with the attitudes in Hungary, because Hungarians hate Russians. Hungarians that I know, they're not angry about 1956 or 1944, 45. I mean, they're still fuming about 1849 when the Russians invaded. They have a long historical memory. They don't like Russians. And it's sort of a popular attitude. It's kind of resistant to reasoning and things like that. You can say, yes, but shouldn't we be on friendly terms with Putin because of it? He's a geopolitical counterweight. They don't want to hear that, right? Their eyes glaze over. They start staring daggers at you. They think you're a foreigner and should never understand. So I don't even try it. But I've had conversations like this with Hungarians. They really don't like Russians, and they're not comfortable with their prime minister trying to be on good terms with them. However, the enemy coalition is just as divided on this issue as they are on the gay sex education issue. Put it that way. They're just as divided on the Russia thing, because there are a lot of people in the right, further to Orban's right, who are part of this coalition, who are drinking from the same sources as, I don't know, the extremely enthusiastic Russia shills that are on the far right in America. People like Andrew Anglin, people like all of UN's Review at this point. Basically the whole front page of UN's Reviews that way. There are people like that in Hungary, and they're in this anti-Orban coalition. So it might have hurt Orban a little, but I think it's hurt his enemies more. So I think a lot of forces are combining that will make it likely that he will be reelected, and that his party will maintain a pretty solid majority, if not the two-thirds majority that they've enjoyed, which has allowed them to change the constitution. I think most Hungarians think he's done a pretty good job, but I'm an outsider, and some of them will you know, roll their eyes because and think I don't even have any right at all to comment on this. Well, you asked me, okay? So that's why I'm commenting on it. ABC has written in with $5. Was the COVID reset a counter-revolutionary action of the globalists in response to populism sweeping the West in 2016? Is the real Russian objective of Ukraine related to the oil and gas in eastern Ukraine and Crimea? Is this the end of globalism? I think this is a bit conspiratorial in its underlying assumptions. I don't think COVID was whipped up as a response to populism. And is the real Russian objective in Ukraine related to oil and gas and Crimea? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think they want to hold on to Crimea for strategic purposes because that's where their Black Sea Fleet is based. And so I think that those are greater concerns than gas and oil. Okay. Is this the end of globalism? It could be the end of the it could be the end of the unipolar moment where the United States is the unchallenged global superpower, which was something that was dreamed of after communism collapsed. I don't think that was ever true in a sense, because while communism was collapsing in Europe, we had been building up communist China into an economic superpower. It was one of the dumbest things in human history to do, frankly, from a geopolitical point of view. It certainly, I think, ended the illusion that America is the global hyperpower. I don't think it's quite over yet, like some of the people who are, you know, cheering this on. And the reason why I don't think it's quite over yet is that, de-dollarization, that's a worrying thing. There's no question about it. However, the status of the United States and NATO, which is basically the United States' security apparatus, its military apparatus in Europe, has never been higher among Europeans because of this invasion. So I think that, yeah, the United States has taken some licks in terms of the use of dollar as the dollar, and that could have enormous negative long-term consequences, economic consequences. The war, no matter what the outcome, is going to have all kinds of economic consequences around the world that could be bad. But America's prestige and NATO's prestige, NATO's prestige and America's prestige as a key component of NATO are much higher in Europe now than they were before this war, which is not a good thing, to be perfectly honest, because there's been a very strong case made by Tukakuru on the writer's block a couple weeks ago that NATO actually has caused Europe's martial culture and actual defense capacities to atrophy when looking at, say, Finland in comparison. Finland is not a NATO country. They've had to build a very strong army in a very small country to go it alone and deter a deter the Russians from invading their country. And so I think that there's a great case to be made that NATO is not actually good for Europe, but try explaining that now when war has returned to Europe and when hundreds of thousands of European people have been forced to flee their country. This is a great moment for NATO. There is a great spontaneous feeling of European solidarity that's happening now. And I think that this is both good and bad. It's great that there's European solidarity. It's bad that NATO is basically feeding off that feeling of European solidarity because it's not ultimately in the long term the best thing for Europe. So anyway, let's move forward. So is this the end of globalism? Well, It maybe not. Okay. I do think that America's power in some ways is going to be knocked back by this, but America is a declining country as it is. I do think in other ways, America's prestige and NATO's prestige have been enormously enhanced by this. And Russia's good opinion in the West has been knocked way, way back amongst normie types, right? It has its cheering gallery, but amongst normies, I think its status has been enormously harmed. So that's basically my thoughts on that. Okay. I also have a question from Mary Lou. Mary Lou wrote in and said, what happened to DLive when Nick Gilvey had Culture War Criminal on? We thought that our DLive channel was canceled, right? It was cut off in midstream. Well, I looked and I got an email from DLive and it explained that we had featured a banned person on our platform. And because of that, they were stopping our streaming ability for 2 hours. Now, the banned person was Ryan Sanchez, culture war criminal, who is on, I guess he's been banned probably around the time that a lot of the Groiper types and Fuentes types were banned after the 6th of January, 2021. He's since, of course, fallen out with the Fuentes crew, and the Fuentes crew have it in for him. Now, I don't know if DLive scans, has an algorithm that scans every stream, right? And sees if the names of any of their people who on the ban list are showing up in the streams and automatically flags the streams and shuts them down. That's a level of totalitarianism I wouldn't put past Google, right? I don't know if DLive does that. I think it's far more likely that some butthurt Groiper types who have it in for Ryan Sanchez saw that he was on stream and it went out to flag the stream and get it shut down. That's the more plausible explanation. And so the stream was shut down for 2 hours, which basically shut it down for the duration of the Ryan Sanchez visit. We continued to stream on Odyssey, and now the stream is put up on a Countercurrents website, so you can look at it there. So that's an answer to that. Hey, Jim. Jim Goad is in the chat. I really appreciate that. So it was statistically safer to be a soldier in World War I than West Virginia coal miner at the same time. Interesting. Thin Red Line, this kind of attitude like blood vengeance is a sign of a weak state because the only thing that can protect you and take care of you is your clan, basically. That's true. 1865 minus 1619 is 246 years. They were never known for their arithmetic skills, right? And it's really what matters is the 9 million who died in the crossing, right? Thomas Steuben writes, non-lethal duels with blunt swords would be less destructive than a lot of lawsuits. This is true. And in fact, we have arbitration options, right? Maybe we could have slug it out options. it's like a mutually agreed upon way of dealing with some of these things. That's actually not such a bad idea. And we're creeping back towards the duel in a way. Interesting. Thin Red Line writes, who knows what's really going on the ground in Ukraine? Well, true. I do know what I'm not going to trust. I'm not going to trust what I see on the Saker and Russia Today and the UNS Review and all those sources for the same reason that I'm not going to trust anything at face value that's coming out of the Western media. However, there are some things you can do. First of all, you can look at the stuff that's coming out of both medias and you can use your brain to try and pick it apart and see if there's like any little truths, creeping through, creeping through the spin and the lies. You can do that. The other thing is that you can go on social media and you can look on various channels. Telegram is swarming with them. There are websites out there that are very, very useful. And you can start getting a picture yourself by looking at cell phone videos and stuff that are being uploaded from Mariupol, from various villages, from the front lines. It's one thing for the Ukrainians to say that they've have shot down 600 helicopters. It's another thing when there are websites that you can start counting the number of downed helicopters and blown up jets and things like that, blown up tanks and so forth. It's you start getting a picture that way, but we'll not know about this until it's over, and it'll take a long time after it's over before we'll know the full casualties on both sides. I do think, though, that the casualties on the Russian side have been substantially higher than they expected. And that let's just say that the Ukrainians are claiming that nearly 18,000 Russians have died so far. I would just cut that number in half. If you cut that number in half, you're close to the total death toll from 10 years in Afghanistan. I think they lost 15,000 in Afghanistan. Maybe it was 10 or maybe it was 15. I can't remember, but that's an astonishing thing, if it's true. Even if you cut the Ukrainian figures in half, it's still a real debacle compared to other recent wars that, and special operations that the Russians have engaged in. So I do think there are a lot of people screaming at one another at the Kremlin right now. I think there's a lot of screaming at the Kremlin because this didn't go according to plan. But you know, we'll know eventually. Yeah. So it took a thin red line. It took the Germans 6 weeks to take France, and that was considered lightning fast. Okay. Well, but the Germans didn't get bogged down on day six either. So I think you can, you know, if they had kept moving forwards, they might have actually taken Ukraine in 6 weeks, but they bogged down at the end of week one. Jim says the world will be bad for Americans. I'm not taking sides. Hilarious how many of the America First guys are taking the side of someone who sees America as his primary enemy. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. But they want what's bad for America too. In the sense that they want what's bad for the American regime, just like Putin wants what's bad for the American regime. And so they can imagine that he's their ally. I don't think that's true, but that's what they imagine. Warball, okay, sports bar, Warball. It's an outlet for tribalism. Yeah, that's what the sports stuff is. The war will weaken its America, especially currency, says Jim. That's true. Optics engaged when being powerless, championing the goals of the leader of another country feels good. Jim says, sure, especially when the end result will leave you more powerless. It makes tons of sense. Yeah, this is true. This is what happens when people grow up with movies and video games. That's really true. There's a lot of gaming mentality here. I mean, a lot of these people are quite actively gamers, And I think some of them have a very, how to put it, apparently you can learn a lot about reality from games, but not everybody says that. E. Muzungu Jones says to Greg, are Ukrainians white? Yeah, he thought that was a killer question. I take offense to the air guitar comment. I don't take offense to it. I mean, it's actually a delightful thing that people play air guitar. But when you ask yourself what this is, what's going on here, it's a fascinating thing. And when you see the political equivalent of air guitar, especially a political equivalent of air guitar masquerading as serious commentary or serious geopolitical thinking, then it is to laugh, right? There were some amusing lines in the E. Michael Jones debate, like when E. Michael Jones said, you want me to take his pants down and look at his penis, actual quote. That was quite wild. There's a question here from Goldfrapp. Okay. Somebody knows the way to my heart by using that name, Goldfrapp. A question from Goldfrapp. Greg, can you share your thoughts on Jim Jones's political and celebrity endorsements? I was shocked to find that Jim Jones enjoyed widespread endorsements from members of the political establishment in the United States before he went off to, was it Guyana, and made them drink the Kool-Aid, right? This is obviously an attack on Nick Fuentes. And I'm not going to dignify this. This is obviously an attack on Nick Fuentes. It's an attack on Michelle Malkin. The idea that because you have political and celebrity endorsements, that means that you're a stand-up guy, is obviously refuted by the fact that Jim Jones, this sinister cult leader who killed, 1,000 people or something like that, including women and children, mostly black people, so that's especially heinous in this world. He made them drink poison Kool-Aid and kill themselves, basically because he was a narcissistic sociopath and he had created this cult around him. And his world was collapsing. His cult was collapsing. The game was finally up. And rather than just admit that it was all a charade, and that if his world was ending, their world was going to end too. That's what happened with him. And he killed all of his followers. I think this is a really cheap shot against Nick Fuentes, and I'm not going to dignify it. Eric has written in. Eric is a great guy. He sends me many questions. I don't get to them all, but I appreciate them. He also is great at sending recommended books for review, and I appreciate that as well. He asked me, what words and phrases do I most overuse? That is actually a really good question. I think it's worthwhile for us to all reflect on that. And I do notice that when I edit my work and when I listen to the playback of things that I say certain things too much. And really what I would love to do is purge all the alt-right online lingo from my vocabulary, because it doesn't age well, it doesn't date well, and a lot of people find it puzzling. And so I would like to stop saying based and cringe and things like that. I don't use globo homo except ironically. I hate that euphemism. I just want to stop sounding like the alt-right and sound more like a guy who's got a PhD in philosophy and the author of umpteen books. I can't remember how many books I've published now. That's really what I'd like to do. If anything, I would like to reform my speech by purging it of alt-rightisms. And a lot of alt-rightisms are Negro-isms, like based, for instance. And I'd like to purge my discourse of that kind of vocabulary as well. I'm trying to monitor that. If you hear me do that, say it in the chat. That's the only way I'm going to learn, folks. It's the only way I'm going to stop this. Jim Goad raises his hand. I have never used online jargon. Never. Yeah. Well, no, this is true. Jim actually is extremely, how to put it, he's a more traditional writer than a lot of us when it comes to that kind of stuff. He's writing for the ages. His stuff isn't going to age as badly as all this online stuff. So anyway, I think that's a very good question. Thank you, Eric. Eric also writes in and asks for my favorite Japanese animation. Because, of course, you know, I was in the movement. I was a part of the online alt-right. So I assume everyone assumes that I like anime. Well, it's true. I do like Japanese animation. Not a whole lot of it, to be perfectly honest, but the high-end stuff, as Jared Taylor once said to me, Miyazaki is a genius. And I do like Miyazaki's films, some of them, not all of them. I don't like Princess Mononoke. I wasn't crazy about that. But I think Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, Porco Rosso, The Wind Rises. These are brilliant films. They're deep in their own odd way. They can be appreciated by children, but they can be appreciated even more by adults. They're extremely artful, and they're not anti-white. In fact, the ones that are set in Europe and deal with Europe are extremely pro-European in ways that Western films seldom are anymore. So I think that that's actually admirable. I think it's good art. It's good entertainment. And it's very, very healthy cinema. So I unironically think Miyazaki is a genius too. So anyway, that's my recommendation there. And Mary Ann, not Mary Lou, Mary Ann has written in. She wants to know, and folks, you're going to get bored at this, I'm afraid. She was the one who asked about classical pop crossover a couple weeks ago. She asks, who are my favorite classical conductors, alive and dead? Okay. You asked. She sent $3. Here's the response. And if you don't want me talking about music and stuff, send your donations, questions, comments about other topics. But I answer all the questions. Okay, who are my favorite classical conductors? Among the dead ones are Herbert von Karajan, Wilhelm Furtwängler, Pierre Boulez, and Kurt Mazur. They're all absolute top-notch conductors, and I really respect them. Among the living conductors, these are people I've actually seen conduct and people that I really love their recordings, are Christian Tielemann, Esa-Pekka Salonen, he's a Finnish conductor, Gustavo Dudamel, and Zubin Mehta. Zubin Mehta has done some of my absolute favorite Richard Strauss recordings. He's done a lot of fantastic recordings. Another one I really like is Charles Dutoit. He's done absolutely fantastic recordings, especially of a lot of the French repertoire, Ravel, people like that. So those are a few that I can highly recommend. Eric also asks me to list some favorite albums. Okay, well, I have two questions that are about music, so I'm going to combine them. Michael asks me, do I think that the 70s sucked in terms of music? And I have to say, no, the 70s did not suck in terms of music. There's a lot of absolutely fantastic music from the 70s. And so this will allow me to name some favorite albums, because there are certain albums that I like as things that I would listen through to as a piece, not just one song or another, but as a piece. And there are several that come from the 70s that I absolutely love and think they're just masterpieces of rock music. Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Also, their follow-up Wish You Were Here, 1973, 1975. Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, one of the great rock albums of all time. Something that you can listen to as a unit. It has no weak links. It's fantastic. David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, Diamond Dogs. Those are albums that I can listen to as a unit. They don't have any weak links. They have a lot of appealing variety in them. They're absolutely fantastic. I really love Led Zeppelin IV, also from the 1970s. And the first Cars album was from the 70s. It was their best album, their first and their best. It's something that you can listen to all the way through without any stops. There's not a weak link in it. I think it's superb. The first Boston album was absolutely fantastic. Again, it's something that can be listened to uninterrupted as a unit and just put on repeat. So those are some things that I really love. I think also from the 1970s, the first couple of Talking Heads albums are absolutely fascinating. Those are from the 70s. So yeah, those are a few things that I definitely can say didn't suck in the 1970s. And of course, the 1970s was the golden age of disco. How can you say that the 70s sucked when it was the golden age of disco, right? Practically every great album by ABBA was from the 1970s. you can't say that the 70s sucked. I know it's popular to say that because it's popular to disdain disco, right? That's just a post-punk affectation. Another post-punk affectation was that you disdained prog rock, that kind of stuff. Well, you know, I listened to all the post-punk stuff, but I still listen to Yes and Boston and that kind of stuff. I think it's great. So the 70s was a great time, and Eric wanted to know some of my favorite albums, so I just gave you a few favorite albums. So anyway, let's see here if there's some other. Yeah, most of Black Sabbath stuff was from the 1970s. And a lot of it's extremely solid. Bowie's best albums were in the 1970s, definitely. And that would include Hunky Dory, as well as Ziggy Stardust and Diamond Dogs. Those are excellent. They don't have weak links on an extremely high level. Most of Queen's best stuff was from the 1970s, but then they had this Indian Summer in the 80s and did some absolutely amazing stuff too. There Lies on All Sides of War. Yes, exactly. As an unspeakable but highly quotable politician once said, during war, truth is the first casualty. That was probably the only true thing he ever said during a war. We were warned, right? So anyway, yeah, we just have to use our intelligence, and we can't just believe things that we're told. We have to take everything with a grain of salt. I'm getting a question here. The question is, Greg, when can we expect the second part of your Russia and Ukraine Again? Russia and Ukraine Again was the title of the written version of my opening statement in the debate with E. Michael Jones. I put it up at Countercurrents last week, and I said at the end that I would publish a sequel which would lay out my rebuttal. Well, I'll bring that out next week. I'm having a little trouble, honestly, with the rebuttal, just like I had in the actual debate. As I said, after Jones finished, that I was just sort of speechless. The reason I was speechless was that he didn't really present an argument. He filibustered for 20 minutes, 4,000 words or so, saying stuff that didn't really amount to a case, but was full of buzzwords that were basically trigger words for retards, frothing retards. I didn't see an argument there, though. So the response that I've written, the rebuttal, is not really so much a rebuttal to him, although I reflect on the fact that there was a vacuum, really, of good arguments in his statement. But I give a rebuttal to just a lot of the arguments that I've heard about this war and the way it's being framed in general. So that's what I've been focusing on. And well, what's the saying? Lies can go around the world three times before truth, you know, can get its shoes on in the morning or something like that. It's a great statement. It's amazing just how much nonsense is out there, and it mutates constantly. And so it's kind of difficult to get a handle on it and get it all in a nice tidy package without wasting my time and your patience. And so I'm having a little trouble condensing it all, but I should be done with it by next week. And that'll be my final statement on this. I'm trying to find a way of making a larger point rather than just, combing through arguments and saying, no, this doesn't follow and this doesn't follow and this is not factual. I don't want to be Ukraine's reply guy. They should have their own reply guys for this. I can't do it. I don't want to do it, but I do want to at least provide a framework for understanding what's going on and reframing the discussion that I think will lead people to the right conclusion. And the right conclusion is, I think that nationalists in the West, especially racial nationalists, should be on the side of Ukraine in this fight. Now, what does that mean to be on their side? It doesn't mean that I'm advocating that the United States get into a war or a NATO get into a war. And I'm not advocating that you pick up a gun and join the Foreign Legion, go to Ukraine or anything like that. I'm simply saying that given the facts and given our values, the side that most reflects our values, that's most consistent with our values as nationalists, is what is the Ukrainian one. They're not perfect, but no country is. But they're the ones, their situation is closer to what we value. That's what I'm arguing. The main reason that I think that there are so many people in our circles who are arguing the opposite is, and I don't want to sound conspiratorial here because, well, frankly, there's too much of that kind of thinking and I don't want to encourage it. But there are conspiracies. And I do believe that there has been a concerted propaganda operation coming out of Russia that directs itself towards the far right and adjacent spheres in Europe and the United States. Generally, the kind of stuff that they push is just propaganda, ways of thinking that lower the trust that people have in the public, in authorities, in their government, things like that, lowers trust in reason, encourages basically crazed conspiratorial thinking, epistemological nihilism, rabid dog style attacks on your enemies, you know, the people who disagree with you. It just encourages a general decline in the cognitive quality of dissent and the ability of people to cooperate with one another and trust one another. It begins with distrusting the authorities, and of course, there's every reason to distrust them. And so it's not hard to make a case for that. But you can't just stop the nihilism train. You can't just stop the decadence train when it gets to your station. It just has a momentum of its own. And this is why I've always opposed people like Alex Jones and thinking that we can get any mileage out of people like Alex Jones. Because he encourages irrationality, and you can't build a society of paranoid people. You can't build a society out of crazy paranoid people. You just can't do that. And so I've always steered clear of that. I do think a lot of Russian ops are just there to break down the social capital of the West. But then from these same circles, you get a lot of stuff that's just designed to destroy and make the right stupid and make society dysfunctional. But then all of a sudden, when there's trouble in Ukraine, and this was in 2013, 2014, and again today, suddenly these same channels are pumping out the Russian propaganda, note perfect, nonstop, right? There's a subculture in the West that is irrational, skeptical of the establishment, that basically promotes a kind of right-wing sounding set of norms and memes that are conducive to social decay. They weaken the West. I don't want any part of that. And I wonder who does. You could say, well, maybe it's, you know, Israel, right? Well, if it were Israel, it would reliably snap to Israel's defense in every case, right? When the only constructive propaganda that comes out of these circles is that sort of note perfect is the pro-Russian stuff. So I think there is a kind of Russian operation that's going on. The pattern, I definitely think somebody like Alex Jones fits the bill. And I know that makes me sound maybe like Hillary Clinton to some of you, but there's no question that I think this pattern is real. And this is one of the reasons why way back in 2016 and earlier, the Russia collusion hoax was being pushed even before the election. And I basically said at a certain point, thanks, Richard Spencer, for giving grist to the mill that people on the right are actually in cahoots with Putin, because, of course, he had turned Radek's journal into a platform for Russia Today talking points in 2013-2014. There's plenty of evidence for those kinds of allegations, and you can find them by visiting a lot of websites that are now gathered together on the front page of the UNS Review. Whatever they're doing, they're not trying to do us any favors. It's working to make America a less functional society. Now, you think that maybe that's good for our cause. But again, I would rather, how to put it, I would rather win arguments and win hearts and win minds than basically just destroy the system by making people hate one another, making people incapable of cooperating and trusting with one another, making people incapable of reasoning, and so forth. I just don't think we can get where we want with nihilism. And that's what I think mostly is coming out of these circles. And I would include a lot of the anti-COVID stuff as this kind of epistemological nihilism. I think if you were a superpower and you wanted to harm other superpowers and there's a pandemic going on, I would absolutely push skepticism about the dominant narrative. And it was very interesting to see how the skeptical arguments were constantly mutating faster than the virus. And the only thing in common was, don't do anything to stop this pandemic, or it's not real to begin with. You can't trust the people who are saying this is a pandemic. If I were an enemy of the United States, that's the kind of propaganda I'd be pushing during a pandemic. I would like somebody to do a study somebody who would have to be a Russian speaker, obviously, to do a study of Russian policy about COVID versus the kinds of things that were covered in Russia Today about COVID. I would suspect that Russia Today would probably be giving favorable coverage to forms of COVID skepticism and COVID denial that were absolutely verboten for Russian consumption in Russia. It's just a hypothesis. I would like to know. It's a testable hypothesis, and I would love to see if somebody can confirm or deny that. And if you know Russian and you want to do a little research on that, get in touch with me. I'll pay you to do it. That I think is what's behind a lot of this. I do think there's a concerted propaganda operation. I remember there was an article by Greg Hood at Radix back in 2014, 2015, which I thought was reflecting the sort of water cooler consensus around Richard Spencer, that wouldn't it be great if Putin would give money to us? Well, all you would need to do is just take his propaganda line on a lot of things. And I was kind of appalled by that. I thought that was basically just an invitation for corruption, right? Matt Heimbach, and of course, Matt Heimbach's trad worker thing made all kinds of overtures to Russia and to Dugin, borrowing their memes, borrowing their symbols, promoting them in talking points. Heimbach said that he believed that Russia was their natural ally, and that he hoped that Russia would basically become the sponsor of people like him in the same way that the United States was the sponsor of the Syrian rebels in Syria. Now, I don't know if any of those dreams came true, right? But there was definitely a willingness to be courted by Russian agents of influence that was being signaled on Radix by Spencer and his company, and with the TWP people, and specifically Heimbach. I don't know if they ever got the deal, right? if any money ever changed hands or if these people even took notice of them. Why pay people if they're willing to sell out on spec in the hopes of getting money? I don't know, but there was definitely a willingness to do that. And I think there's definitely a willingness on the part of Russia to engage in subversive activity directed to the right. I don't like it. I don't like it because I don't like lies and I don't like corruption. I don't like people who are basically willing to sell their platforms to foreign entities, and especially when it requires these people who will pretend like they're wink, wink, nudge, nudge Nazis when they talk to you to suddenly be going on about denazifying Ukraine and how that's really not a problem, right? You have people in the NJP saying, you know, it's really not a problem for Putin to be talking about denazifying Ukraine. Well, I'm sorry, guys, something's amiss there, right? Somebody's either dumb or deluded or corrupt. There aren't any plausible explanations for this level of bad, this pattern of bad ideas, bad takes. It's not random. So yeah, I do think that there is a massive op that's been directed at us. And I would like to, have people, help get to the bottom of this. I'd like to see more investigation of this. But I'm just going to sketch a little bit of that out at the end of this piece. But I think we should be aware of this. I can't prove this at present. It's a hypothesis. Treat it as a hypothesis. See if facts fall into place when you look at facts with this framework in mind. Okay, folks, I'm going to give one more quick look at the DLive chat. Thomas Dubin says Russian media has disavowed the Putin shilling in the West because it's become so embarrassing and out of control. Yes, that's true. Friedrich Richter, speaking of signaling, Giorgiani wrote a book, Close Encounters, arguing that Nazis and UFOs are out to get us. Okay, that's cool. Respect to Taco, if you're a white nationalist wanting to stop the replacement of Slavs in Russia, definitely. It could be all these people have come to the same view. Yeah, that's possible. It could be that they've all come to the same view for the same reasons, which have nothing to do with facts. And that's one hypothesis that I think is worth exploring. If I were an enemy of the United States, I would welcome open borders for the United States, which exactly is what is happening. Is winning an argument more important than the truth? No, I don't think so. Jim Goad, I'd kind of love to watch the online accelerationists being forced to forage for foodstuffs and find clean water. I don't think they would know what to do if the electricity went out. Their internet and their phone signals would be dead. What would they do without the internet and phone signals? For Paul Anvil, Russia's corrupt for sure, but is it a Jewish kleptocracy hell-bent on destroying its own people the way Western governments are? Let's just put it this way. There's a certain logic of empire that you see in Russia and you see in the West. And both of them are destructive of the ethnic interests of the people who are involved. How does an empire grow? Well, an empire grows by one people dominating another people. Okay, so how does that happen? Well, it means that there's a certain leader or leadership caste in a society that is willing to take its own people and send them out as soldiers to fight and die in order to take over another people's land. Okay, so empires grow by rulers basically trading the lives of their own people for foreign conquests. And then what they do once they have taken over these foreign countries is they try and co-opt some of the natives to rule over the natives and also help them to collaborate with them. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, what they'll do is they'll take some of the native elites and they'll promote them. And they'll take them to places far away from their homelands where they don't have any connection to the local people. And they'll use them as tools of domination over the locals because it's better to use foreigners to crush people than natives, because the natives obviously have some kind of solidarity with the people they're supposed to crush. Okay, so empires work by shuffling people around. They work by trading the lives of the natives for foreigners, taking foreigners and using them to oppress the natives, moving populations around, diluting one population, one conquered people with another conquered people. That's a game that Russians have played. That's a game that empires have played for thousands of years. So it's inherently hostile to the ethnic genetic interests of the founding population, whose lives are basically spent to create an empire for some elite, and then who are ruled over by foreigners who are more reliable as tools to crush them than their own people. There's something highly sociopathic about that. And the logic of race replacement in the West is not entirely different. We have an elite that doesn't trust the founding population of European white societies and wants to dilute them with non-whites, wants to replace them. Why? So they can dominate them better. So I see the same basic pattern in both societies. It's not a good pattern. This is why I oppose empires. Empires always work by sacrificing the native population for foreign conquest and then using foreigners to oppress the natives when it's all over. And they do that, if an empire dominates 50 peoples, it's using 50 peoples against one another, right? One of our commentators at Countercurrents pointed out that in the 1905 war between Russia and Japan, the Russian Empire didn't conscript ethnic Russians at the same rates as it conscripted peoples, conquered peoples, Ukrainians, Moldovans. Apparently, they conscripted like 80% of the 18-year-olds in Moldova. And they were just cannon fodder, basically. And it didn't matter, right? They were the subject people. Their lives didn't matter all that much. But they probably used Moldovans as tools for suppressing the Russians in other areas where the population was majority Russian. That's how empires work. And I challenge you to say that that the West is not any more sociopathic than Russia is in terms of applying the logic of empire, which includes basically betraying and replacing the native stock, okay? Playing people off against one another. Jim Goad asks, where are the non-corrupt governments? Well, the governments that are most likely to not be corrupt are governments in highly ethnically homogeneous societies, in especially European societies. So the most genetically similar societies in Europe are among the least corrupt. That would include Denmark, Iceland, places like that. If you want to get rid of corruption, you have to have an elite that is organically connected with the masses, preferably that where the masses have the power to check their excesses. And where there's a solidarity, a cultural, racial solidarity between rulers and ruled. That's the way you get non-corrupt government. That's one of the factors, definitely. Jim Goad on Alex Jones, I suspect he's being used to delegitimize the very idea that conspiracies exist. Well, in a way, that's true. I first formulated this idea with the 9/11 conspiracy stuff, because I thought it was so outlandish And it was argued in such bad faith. That's when I really started thinking about conspiracy stuff and wondering if there was a conspiracy behind the conspiracies. Because, and in this case, I'm pretty sure it's an Israeli/Jewish conspiracy. This is my thought. A few days after September 11th, 2001, there were polls that were released by NBC and Reuters stating that 2/3 of the American public believed that this happened because of our relationship with Israel. All those lies, all that careful refusal to deal with certain facts, and still 2/3 of the population realized the truth about this situation. We were struck because of our relationship with Israel. The United States basically is a giant farm that Jews use to raise up soldiers to throw at their enemies, right? And to create weapons that they use against their enemies. And people don't like that, and that's why we were hit. 2/3 of the public believed that. There were the dancing Israeli stuff was true. There was credible evidence that the Israelis had foreknowledge of this, etc. There was a real conspiracy that is adjacent to the absolute masterpiece of conspiracy theorizing, which has to do with the Jewish conspiracy, to put it bluntly. And this was in danger of coming out. And so how to stop this? How to stop it? Well, if you can't just suppress it entirely, you've got to get in there and poison the well. You've got to muck it up. And so suddenly the 9/11 truth movement came out, and the 9/11 truth movement was full of crazy stuff about controlled demolitions and nanothermite and disappearing airplanes. And basically it just tainted the whole thing with an aura of insanity so that people would not look at the conspiracy theories. And of course that kept them away from the real conspiracy, the obvious open conspiracy that led to the whole thing, having to do with Project for the New American Century, Jewish domination of American foreign policy, etc. That is what was done. They basically poisoned the well so that people wouldn't drink from it, so that people wouldn't discover the truth. Now, I think that's a tried and true way of handling truths that you can't completely suppress. If you can't completely suppress truths, then how do you deal with them? How do you prevent them from hurting you? Well, you basically have to, excuse me, vaccinate people against them. How do you vaccinate people against the truth about 9/11? By basically injecting alternative dissident spaces with absolute crazed lunacy so that people won't even listen to a reasonable alternative explanation of it. That's what's going on. And I think we know for a fact that the John Birch Society started pushing conspiracies about globalists, just like Alex Jones. It's the globalists, right? They started pushing conspiracies about globalists precisely to crowd out discussion of the Jewish question. We know this for a fact because Revelo Oliver was involved with these people at the beginning and was purged and saw the fake Judenrein kosher conspiracy theories being manufactured to crowd out critical thinking about Jewish power. Well, there's a long tradition of that. It works so well that why would they ever stop doing it? It's mutated, it's taken on new forms, it's gone into new medias, but yeah, it's there. Now, in the case of Jones, I don't think he particularly serves Jewish interests, although kind of accidentally he does, by just, basically, if you are a corrupt elite and you want to hold on to power, you would really like dissident types to be so marginalized and cranky and so incapable of communicating with the wider world and trusting one another that, you know, that basically they can't do anything. If you were a corrupt elite that wanted to keep in power, one of the things you could do is degrade social trust so much that the people you rule over can never unite to overthrow you. So in that sense, I think that this whole kind of discourse serves their interest because they are the corrupt elite that rules us. But when he so reliably starts parroting this stupid stuff from the Kremlin whenever it's needed, I just think he's their asset. He's their asset, and everything that he says basically helps their interests. And so that's my working hypothesis. I think that people who are adjacent to him and have the same kind of propaganda lines, and that would include Andrew England, consciously or unconsciously, whether on the payroll or not, they're basically serving the interests of Russia, right? They're not serving the interests of white people here or around the world. They're not really making it easier for us to fight this system and overthrow it. They're making it very, very difficult because, again, if you have a completely atomized dissident sphere or just a completely atomized society in general with no ability to form any kind of social solidarity to resist the establishment can have no credibility whatsoever. It can have no legitimacy whatsoever, but they still can't be dislodged because there will never arise a force that has the cohesion necessary to overthrow them. So this is my thinking on the matter. This is for a book someday, and it's not a book that I'm going to write, but maybe it's a book that I will publish if I can find somebody who wants to do this kind of research. ABC is written in with $5. Thank you very much. Geopolitical strategic interests, Black Sea dominance, economic interest, energy, electoral interest, 83% Russian support for Putin after the war, Levada polls. When these interests converge, that's when things happen. It's logic. Yes and no. I think another factor that definitely played a role in this is Sleepy Joe Biden. I think that Putin wouldn't have dared this with the madman Trump in the White House, but Sleepy Joe Biden was weak and confused enough that he thought he could just roll the guy. It's a very, very dangerous gamble, frankly, because he's losing it and he's going around saying things that could get us into a wider war. And his handlers are constantly backpedaling, and then he's saying that he's not walking anything back. It's catastrophic. It could be catastrophic, right? I don't think that it would have happened with Trump in the White House. I think that the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was a good thing, followed by the swift collapse of the regime there, which the United States predicted was not going to happen like that, which was a very bad thing for the United States. I think that the Afghan collapse, the rapid collapse after Afghanistan, the hurried evacuation at the end, basically made the planners at the Kremlin and in Beijing open their filing cabinets and take out the files for Ukraine and Taiwan and start evaluating whether or not they should make the grab. I think the next big geopolitical crisis, as soon as this thing starts simmering down, it's going to be Taiwan. This is what happens. You might hate the United States. You might hate its evil influence in the world. I certainly hate what the country's become, and I hate its evil influence in the world. But we might learn to hate the absence of America's power even more. It's an argument that you get from Thomas Hobbes. It's an argument you get from Pascal. The reason why you have sovereigns, you have kings, you have rulers, even when they're bad rulers, is because the absence of these people leads to chaos and civil war, which is worse, right? And so sometimes you miss even the bad ruler. I think that the Ukraine crisis has been caused by America weakening and America having a weak president. I think there will be more crises in the Far East. I think that if the United States has two crises on its hands with major powers, that there will be other things starting to pop up all around the globe. There could be a lot of chaos. A lot of chaos, and people might start missing the American empire. And that's a bad thing. It's not an argument for the American empire, but it is an argument for stability. We might hate stability, but instability is far worse. And there are 1,000 little wars that could pop up all over the world, and will probably pop up all over the world in the coming months if China goes for Taiwan, then I think all bets are off in practically every little border war from Kosovo to Somalia to, East Timor and places like that. Things could go completely crazy all over the world because people will take their opportunities. I think this was a crime of opportunity in Ukraine. I think there will be other crimes of opportunity before this is all over. So Spartan says, I suspect the next election in the USA will be more painful compared to the last one. I think this is actually true. folks, I really appreciate this. I enjoy these solo streams because I have good questions, stimulating questions. And I will be back next week. In the first hour, I'm going to have Fenech Soler, who's written a number of novels, including a novel that was recently republished. You can get it at Amazon, and I'm sure we're going to get it at Countercurrents too, called The Partisan. We've interviewed him before. He's a wonderful fellow. He's written a lot for Countercurrents. He writes a lot for Patriotic Alternative, and I'm looking forward to having him on the show. In the last hour, we'll probably do an AMA as well. And tomorrow, we have the best month ever on the writer's block with Nick Gilvey, joined by Thomas Steuben, who's in the chat here. Thomas Steuben is one of our bright young writers. I really appreciate his work. And they're going to be talking about the top articles from last month at Countercurrents. That'll be on the writer's block tomorrow on our Odyssey channel, on our DLive channel. I hope he's not banned from DLive. We'll find out. On Odyssey and DLive, starting at 1 o'clock Pacific time, 4 o'clock Eastern time, 10 p.m. Central European time. That's where Nick is in Macedonia. So folks, join us tomorrow. We will be back next week with another Countercurrents Radio.